Welcome back to the Education Matters podcast, guys. We got a good one today. I have a conversation with our Dean of Nursing and Health Sciences, Dr. Patrick Robinson. It's a really thoughtful conversation. He's got a great story. Most excitedly, while we were recording it, we learned that the Higher Learning Commission had signed off on a really innovative, revolutionary program that we've got called our RN to BSN FlexPath option, which is a way to go from the RN to the BSN degree in a flexible direct assessment format that Patrick explains during our conversation. And he's just a really interesting guy with a lot to say. He brings a lot of energy and academic pedigree to our school, and we're thrilled to have him. He's made a real impact over the last 5 months. And I hope you guys enjoy the conversation. Thanks. Patrick, thank you for making time this afternoon.
You're very welcome.
So I have a lot of stuff that I want to cover. But first, in these conversations, I like to kind of start by just learning a little bit about the person I'm talking to.
Sure.
And so let's start with, where were you born and what was growing up like for you?
Well, I was born in San Antonio, Texas, but the only time I actually know that is when I look at my passport.
Yeah.
Because my dad was military.
Okay.
So actually, I grew up in Lafayette, Indiana, so a college town.
Sure.
And medicine was in my blood. I was raised by a physician father and a nurse mother.
Okay.
So 12 years of Catholic school, was involved in all the arts and theater growing up. And I loved high school. My 30th high school reunion was last weekend. And a lot of those kids I had been with since first grade. So it was like going home with my brothers and
sisters.
Really cool. It was
a
very
blast.
Cool. Oh, my God. Yeah.
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 We won't dig too deeply into the 30th
well,
high school reunion.
The 80s were a little crazy. Let's just say that.
Well, we can all agree on that.
Yep.
Did you have like a beautiful flock of seagulls haircut?
Oh, my God. I can't believe you actually said
that. No, I can see it on your
flock
right now.
Of seagulls. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's why I keep telling people not everyone remembers what that even means.
Oh, I'm so, all right. I got you.
Flock of seagulls.
Physician father, nurse mother,
mm-hmm.
Was that always a path that you were going to go down?
No, I was supposed to be starring on Broadway at this point in the but you have to have a little something called talent to do that. People were afraid to tell me that I didn't have that, you know.
How long did you pursue acting?
You know, it was always my hobby.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I went to college thinking I was going to do something in the arts, but very quickly realized that I wanted stability. And I saw nursing as something very stable. But if you had told me that I was going to have a PhD in nursing someday, I really would have thought that you were a little bit out of your mind.
So let's take that on two levels, because a lot of the people who are going to be listening to this conversation are people who were in similar shoes to you, right, and maybe a similar journey. So what was it that led you to nursing first off?
Sure.
And then why the decision to pursue the PhD?
Yeah, so the nursing, choosing nursing, and I chose it as an 18-year-old, you know, so I was a kid. It was a very pragmatic choice. You know, it was like I wanted something stable. I wanted something that I thought I might be good at. So nursing seemed a logical choice. I had been working only in healthcare ever since I was 15. So, you know, when your dad's a doctor and your mom's a nurse, my summer jobs were being a nursing assistant or an orderly.
Yep.
So I had done the whole, you know, $3.35 an hour nursing assistant and literally doing physical care to people. And I was kind of drawn to the culture of being part of a healthcare team, which I found nurses were always very inviting to me, so I was very comfortable. So I thought, yeah, this is something that I can do. As I got into school, I realized actually it was pretty cool and that there was a lot that I could do with it. And I got very drawn to the whole idea of being an academic and being a researcher. And when I graduated from my master's degree, I went straight through bachelor's to master's. It was sort of at the beginning of – not the beginning, but at the height of the AIDS epidemic. And that's what I spent my clinical career doing.
Yep.
And I was so committed to it and had so many great mentors. years because we were all figuring out that it was just natural for me to want to continue my education and do AIDS research. Yep. And
so I want to dig in on that. Mm-hmm. Was it what drew you to the research? Was it the mm-hmm. idea of being a researcher,
mm-hmm.
or that in combination with a passion around doing AIDS research?
It was the AIDS, because I guess, you know, I was young enough and naive enough. I'm not sure I knew what a researcher was, but I knew that my patients were actually kind of suffering and that there was a lot that still needed to be understood and a lot that nurses could do. So I was drawn to that, you know, how do you enhance quality of life in these patients who at that time were all, you know, close to death or actively yep. dying. So it wasn't actually till I was half. I kind of started all my academic programs with healthy naivete. it wasn't, you know, until I sort of got into my second year of coursework where I really started to understand what a researcher was and yep. that there was all this external funding and grant writing and publications, which I did for the majority of my time. But no, it was definitely drawn to what the outcome of research like that could be. And I did really cool stuff. In my doctoral work, I started looking at the effect of meditation and yoga on actual immune response in advanced AIDS. So I was trained at the bench in immunology, actually doing the assays, looking how immune cells function under different, you know, drawing the subject's blood and the doing all kinds of neat things in order to see how the immune cells within that blood was functioning, and then looking at the difference between patients who were meditating and doing yoga and patients that weren't. And then I did a postdoc in exercise physiology and started to look at the difference all in HIV and looking at what the effect of exercise on immune function uh-huh. and health. And
how did you arrive at that line of research?
You know, I don't, because I'm not a meditator and I don't do yoga. I'm not, and I am not the type of, I tried, but it's really not, it's very difficult yeah. for me to quiet my mind. I'm an avid reader, and, you know, there was at the time, Bill Moyers was doing a mm-hmm. series called The Healing of the Mind. It's a fascinating series, and he wrote a book of it, and it was just compilations each week. There was different workers who were doing different things with mind-body medicine, and I got really intrigued. The field is called psychoneuroimmunology, okay. and I got really fascinated by the physiological connection between the mind and the body,
yep.
that, you know, your thoughts actually produce hormones and cytokines and neurotransmitters. And so that whole idea, and then what you could do to sort of modulate that process. And one of those parts of the series was a fellow by the name of Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was pioneering what is called mindfulness-based stress reduction. And what he was showing, and that's the intervention that I test, and what he was showing is that chronic pain and anxiety and all these things that really you couldn't treat with traditional pharmacology and so forth were responding really well, and there was powerful abatement of symptoms yep. with just meditation and yoga. And I thought, well, let's try that in HIV. And it really got the first article I published off of that got a lot of press and got a lot
find?
Of calls. Powerful effect on several immune system parameters, including the ability for cells to actually activate, were higher in patients huh. with who were meditating and doing the yoga.
Did it change practice?
You know, I would say it's hard. You know, that type of research is really hard to do and to get big sample sizes.
Yeah.
So you kind of ended up being in the canon of, mm-hmm. You know, evidence for things like this. But still to this day, 15 years later, I get emails from people wanting my data to put it into meta-analyses and so forth. Okay. So, yeah.
So I want to spend a little more time on your process of getting the PhD.
Sure.
How challenging was it for you? And what were the things that the traits, the work habits, the ability to frame up the work in your mind that allowed you to be successful?
Yeah.
Because I think about our learners listening to this, right? Yeah. What would you say – here's a better way to ask the question. What would you say to them when they – if they asked you, how am I going to be successful?
You know, I think – if you have the desire to get a PhD, you have the ability to get a PhD, because I think only a certain subset of people will ever even put that into their mind that they want a doctoral degree. So to me, it's about perseverance, and it is a long, long journey. And there's always that point in the process where it's like, you know, there's too much behind you to stop, but way too much ahead of you to even think about finishing, and you get depressed and so forth. So to me, it was just about tenacity.
Yep. So when you got to that point, too much behind you, but too much ahead. How did you get to the other side?
I always wanted to be. As I start, the part about me that I didn't say earlier, but I wanted to be a professor shortly after I got to college. I mean, I loved nursing, and I loved that. I was lucky because I had two vocations in my life, and they were true vocations. But the whole process of being a teacher always excited me, and maybe that's a little bit of the frustrated actor in me also.
Sure.
But I wanted to be in the classroom with students so bad, and that just always drove me. I always knew what my goal was, and I knew that was, and I kind of knew that really, if you just keep trudging, you're going to make it. You're going to make it.
Yep.
And I did.
What was your support system like?
Very good. Very good. I was fortunate enough to not have to work during my dissertation phase. Of course, I was staying up all night doing those assays, drawing the blood late at night after my sessions. And, of course, I was an RN, and so I had saved a lot of money. I had a master's degree, so I was able to so I had saved enough to pay for it, so I didn't have to worry about that. And, of course, nurses make great money working supplemental, so I had that. Yep. I had good support system, great family, good friends.
Yep. So then you get the PhD. What was next?
I did a 3-year postdoctoral fellowship because in order to be a researcher, you have to get a lot of preliminary work done, because my goal was always to get that big federal grant that was going to launch my big career. So I spent 3 additional years.
What'd you do for postdoc?
It was all in exercise physiology and expanding some of that work to look at the effect of strength training and aerobic exercise on all kinds of parameters. At that point, HIV disease had changed quite dramatically. We were in the age of now no longer were people actually dying, but it was the period right after one of the new types of medications came on the market, and they were causing significant metabolic disturbances. So people with HIV were starting to look like old people with incredibly high cholesterol, triglycerides, and cardiovascular disease. It was a syndrome called lipodystrophy, which is not too prevalent today, because, I mean, there's been generations of meds in the last 10 years. So at that point, what we were worried about is quality of life, but quality of life in as far as reversing some of these metabolic abnormalities. So we were really talking about a lot of fat deposits around the middle. So it's just like what we're as middle-aged men right now we're finding. That's what they were doing. So high cholesterol, high triglycerides, fat around the middle, insulin resistance, so the whole kind of metabolic syndrome. So I thought, well, this makes sense. Let's see what exercise can do for that. And I did that for the 3 years and then took a tenure track position at the University of Illinois and had the best mentor in the entire world, Dr. Joan Shaver, who's now the dean at the University of Arizona. And by the time I left there 10 years later, I had had my research funding, I had taught what I wanted to teach, and I was the executive associate dean of the college.
So I want to pick up there, but let's go back to Dr. Joan Shaver, because a lot of the people who are listening to this are in need of great mentorship and want to be great mentors.
Yeah.
What made her a great mentor?
She did not force Patrick into any kind of traditional mold because I was an untenured assistant professor who had a lot going on and wanted to do a lot of things. And she didn't insist that I spend all of my time writing grants. Interestingly, Joan was a very accomplished scientist. I went to the University of Illinois as a postdoc. So she was my postdoctoral mentor. Okay. And then she hired me on faculty. So even though she was primarily what I was, there to do during the postdoc was research training, she wanted me to teach very soon afterwards. She knew that I was very interested in curriculum development. She gave me my first administrative position as an untenured assistant professor, which you don't do, and she got a lot of heck for it, too, I'm sure. But always listened, always was there to give the – boy, there were times when she's like, oh, boy, you really said the wrong thing in that meeting. And this is what people are saying about you. It's not what I'm saying, and, so it toughened me up. And, to this day, I still go down. She's in Tucson. I still use her. When I was preparing, I didn't even think about – talking to Capella about this job until I had got on an airplane and gone down there and said, what do you think? What do you know? What do you, all these things. So it's just, what makes it is carving out that time and really listening to what that person wants to be and not making them a mini me.
Yep.
And I think that's lot really of important. What mentors try to do. They try to make mini me's, and that's great if that's what the person wants, but I was going to be no version of anybody.
Yep. So I want to talk about you coming here and what we're doing at Capella. But first, there's something that jumped out as I was going through your CV, your bio.
Uh-huh.
President of the National Association of Nurses and AIDS Care.
Mm-hmm.
And as an officer of the HIV AIDS Nursing Certification Board.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that work. How did you
so
get that position and what did it entail?
So part of my life has always been that service component, dedication to the profession. So as soon as I graduated from my undergraduate program and became an AIDS nurse, I became a member of the Association of Nurses in AIDS Care. So for 15 years, I held elected or appointed positions within the association. And then at some point, we created the certification exam, and that was the certification board, and held positions in that. So to me, that was all, and still to this day, I'm very involved in the organization. That's really part of being a professional, is to be very highly involved in the professional societies. And again, like I went into my first meeting in the early 90s and said, I want to be the – I saw the guy up there on stage. His name was Cliff Morrison. Cliff was a luminary in HIV care. He had written the book on it, all of this stuff. And I looked at that board. I was in my 20s. And I said, I'm going to be president of this association someday. And 13 years later, I was the president.
What did you learn in that role?
Oh, my God. I learned what I learned about leadership is that it's never about you, that especially in a membership organization, everybody comes to the table with the same kind of passion, and you have to be really solicitous of that, and you have to listen, and that you are simply the steward of that for a very short period of time, but it belongs to those members. And I wish I could be the president today, because the mistakes I made as president are, they're so huge in my book, you know. Just like I wish I could go back with what I know now and have my first nurse manager job. I would love to go back to my very first year of teaching and say I'm sorry to the students. and, you know, when I go to the meetings in actually next month, it'll be my 25th ANAC conference. And I still think I need to apologize to some of the members. just because, you know, the older you get, your ego starts to get in check and you start to realize those things. And so it really prepared. Plus, it opened the world up to me. I mean, I was in 3 continents once in a month, because that was the time when HIV was becoming such an international issue. So it opened up doors to me about what it's truly like to be poorly resourced. I saw firsthand the connection between comprehensive health policy and care. I was invited to testify before the President's Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. I was invited to, I made tons of Hill visits to the people who were, the staff of the major people on, you know, the funding committees and who were big advocates for HIV and public health. So, oh my God, I would never be where I am today if it wasn't for that association. But I let them know that every time I go back, I'm their product, I'm their kid.
Yeah.
And now I'm almost a 50-year-old man. I said, you're responsible for this.
For the learner listening to this, understanding the involvement in the critical nature of involvement in professional societies, what advice would you have for them about engaging themselves deeply in that?
Absolutely. So I consider it an ethical and professional obligation. So when you're looking at, you know, so in nursing or in public health or in healthcare administration, those that, you know, the programs that are in my portfolio, there are robust professional associations that cover the professions as a whole and then tons of subspecialties. That's where the work is. That's where the action is. That's where policy is influenced. So why wouldn't you want to be a part of that? And you have to start off, you know, going to meetings and volunteering. So, you know, every national association has committees, and a lot of national associations have chapters. So, and those chapters have officers and committees. So you start off small like that, and you know, you have to make a decision about how much of your professional life you want to devote to that. For me, it was huge. In my career, my career did not progress as fast as it would if my research career, if I was not my research career, my academic career would have progressed faster if it wasn't for my involvement in those. And I had all kinds of people tell me, no, you can't do this at this point in your career. It's not the right time. You have to focus on your research. But again, it's like nobody's going to put me in a box. You can't put baby in a corner. So just get involved, get on committees, run for office. And it is really going to, I think it'll really make an impact on individuals' careers. It did on mine. And that, I think that's a common story. That's where you find mentors too.
Yep.
It's still those people that I call now, not my Joan who I was talking about before, but there are still tons of people that I met in those early days that I still call when I need something.
All right. So shifting forward, We're in about you're in about your fifth month at Capella. So first, how's the experience been?
You know, I'm not disappointed. it was the right move for me. I think that during the vetting process, some things came very clear to me, and that is about the culture and the people and the emphasis on quality and innovation, and all of those have panned out to be very much a part of what this job is. So the people actually are probably the way I was treated during the process was extraordinary, but I think this is probably one of the most nurturing, hospitable cultures I've ever worked in.
That's great to hear.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit, so this is a very broad question, about the evolving role of nursing.
Yeah.
And what it means for our school.
Yeah. So I don't think it is an exaggeration to say that there probably is, as far as a profession goes, few that are less dynamic and than nursing at this point, healthcare in general. And that's because there are so many factors coalescing that are just speeding things up like, you know, you can't believe. I mean, just two that are causing shifts that are monumental are the passage of the Affordable Care Act and its continuing implementation each year. So it's not the same every year. So, and I don't know if everyone gets that. You know, 2005 saw changes that were not here in 2004. And then, of course, we have the baby boomers now reaching their age of highest consumption of healthcare resources. So they're challenging in a whole different way, and then the rise of consumerism, and I could go on and on forever. So the role of nurses and the role of healthcare professionals changes along with all of that. At this time, we are, you know, facing shortages of nurses and shortages of healthcare workers. So it means that we have to design the professional role differently.
Yeah.
Things have to be shifted.
Yep.
And that's kind of where we are right now. And things become, tactics become, tactics change that we have to focus on. For example, and just one that I think is very salient right now with value-based reimbursement is that uncoordinated care actually now results in uncompensated care. So nurses, who are the ones at, you know, with the most contact with the patient, we have to take a very, very active role in care coordination. Now, they always had to for quality and safety, and I think we've been very good at that. But now there's even increased incentives because if the care is not coordinated and so forth, the hospital's not going to get reimbursed. So nursing is shifting from what it's from what it was, and it's been shifting though my whole career. So it's emerged from very technical, close, hands-on care. All of that is still there, but increasing demands for coordination, increasing demands for high-level problem solving. And then we have the whole emergence of the advanced practice role, which research is showing that, you know, the majority of primary care in this country can be managed by advanced practice nurses at a lower cost and at the same or higher quality.
Yep.
So, you know, there's the whole burgeoning role of advanced practice nurses in primary care. So Capella is keeping up with that by making sure that we're very responsive to employers. I mean, we live that. It's not just a tagline somewhere.
Yep.
I spent part of last week in Dallas at a chief nurse executive roundtable asking them exactly the questions, like what should a university like Capella be doing in terms to serve your needs, and more specifically, what are the, we're a competency-based education. Yep. So an even further question, what are the competencies you're looking for in an experienced nurse transitioning to the baccalaureate level? What are the competencies you're looking for in a nurse leader who's experienced? And trying to stay on top of that, creating both continuous improvement within our current offerings, but being on the cutting edge to make sure that we're creating new offerings that are responding to those needs.
What did you hear when you asked that?
You know, I think care coordination is a big one, and coordination of care and interprofessionalism are hot on everybody's list right now. That makes perfect sense because healthcare is delivered as a team. Lack of communication and inability to understand each other results in poor quality, results in errors, and it results in uncoordinated care. So that's really big on everybody's list. So it's, you know, weaving those things in terms of our undergraduate offerings. We've already created our master's and certificate programs in care coordination. So we're keeping up. And then, you know, it's giving us sort of, you know, we reflect then on what does this mean for emerging roles.
Just as we've been sitting here, we got news about the Higher Learning Commission's approval of our RN to BSN FlexPath program.
Yes.
Talk a little bit, for someone who isn't familiar with the innovation behind that, and it's a different model. Talk about how it works and why, for some people, it might be a good fit.
Yeah. So, without question, the FlexPath offerings and our edge runner or front runner status in this type of programming was a major attraction of Capella for me, and especially as a nurse, because I do believe that this is the type of educational offering that nurses have been, that we've been clamoring for decades. So briefly, the model is very different than a traditional academic programming. It's called direct assessment. So what this means is that the working professional, and I'll keep it to nursing so I can use the right nouns. So the working nurse is able to use his or her prior experience as a professional nurse, anything that they've learned through their own continuing education, to be able to demonstrate the competencies that are within, in this case, our new the program option that was just approved was our RN to BSN. So we have uncoupled the the courses and the competencies from credit hours or contact hours. So the person actually focuses on the assessment. It's not easy. They still need to spend time learning the content, and they can do that for a variety of ways. They can choose their own materials. They can we give them lots of help with finding those resources. But when they're ready, they go ahead and take the assessment, which could be a paper, it could be a project, it could be some kind of assignment that's in response to a virtual simulation. So for the learner, the nurse, who already is competent in one area, they might be ready very quickly to take that assessment. And they don't have to spend time relearning that. They don't have to dedicate contact hours to learning that. They just take the assessment, and then they spend more time on the things that they don't know. So in this way, the learner can progress through more courses in any given term, and there's not a set number of courses that you you know, you can take. It's all based on what your ability is to pass these competencies, and it's at a cost per term.
Yeah.
So the individual actually could finish the RN to BSN program in less time. What's really revolutionary from the perspective of nursing about this is what we've been talking about for five decades. So RN to BSN education has always been challenged because a lot of our nurses 50 years ago, 30 years ago, our nurses were primarily educated in diploma programs. Well, when they had to then go to get their BSN, there was a time when we made them retake all of their clinicals. So even though they were practicing and they learned how to take care of patients, we had to make them go back and they had to take their adult health, their pediatrics, their OB. Now we've progressed past that point, but there's still a lot of things, if you've been an experienced nurse, that you really know how to do while still in their BSN programs, because we're tied to credit hours and time in seat or time online. You still have to spend your time trudging through that when actually you could pass the test pretty easily. So really, to me, the FlexPath model is the fulfillment of what we in nursing have been trying to do at the baccalaureate level now for almost five decades.
It's pretty exciting.
That's why I said it was one of the factors that really drew me here. The other thing about it is, you know, no nurse goes back to school probably with the ability to devote most of his or her time to it. So all nurses who are in any of our programs, and certainly our RN to BSN program, are professional registered nurses, which means they're probably working as a registered nurse. So already our standard path offers a lot of flexibility because it's asynchronous, but this offers maximal flexibility that people can, you know, study, take the assessments when they want. There is a requirement that you have to engage in the course on a weekly basis. This offers maximum flexibility, awards nurses for what they already know. And that's exciting because the last thing you want is someone spending time on something that they've been doing for 5 years in the workplace. I mean, we will have nurse managers in this RN to BSN FlexPath. And the competency assignments around sort of those management competencies, they will probably likely be able to finish very effectively and efficiently. So it's really exciting.
And it comes at a time when we have a national imperative, at least for magnet hospitals, to move more of our nursing professionals from RN to BSN.
Absolutely. So in 2010, the Institute of Medicine issued a report. It was called the Future of Nursing Report. And it was based on there was a lot of things in that report. But there was one part of the report that said, you know, a highly educated nursing workforce is good for the health of society. And we're like, well, duh. But what was different at that point is for the first time in history, we actually had the evidence.
Yeah.
So Linda Aiken out of the University of Pennsylvania, Sean Clark and their team actually had published some what is now known as seminal research on decreases in morbidity and mortality in hospitals. And it's a complicated study, but in essence, it was patients' mortality and morbidity are decreased in hospitals with higher percentages of BSN-prepared nurses. So that research went into the IOM finding, but that was just the beginning. So it's been 5 years since the release of that, and I would say the majority of the research has been done since then.
Yep.
And it's now been replicated in Europe. It's been replicated in Australia. I believe there's a big Asian study, maybe it's Korea, where similar outcomes have been found. So it's the imperative is one for safety and quality healthcare. And that's why the recommendation is that nurses should have their baccalaureate degree. The magnet designation predates all of this. Yeah. The magnet designation came from some research research that showed there are certain things about a hospital that attract nurses. They were called forces of magnetism. So it actually means a magnet. It attracts nurses. There's been a lot of work done on that. Those have been altered to a point they're no longer called forces of magnetism. They've been sort of condensed and they go under a different name now, but part of the magnet designation is highly educated workforce participation and research and those types of things that educated nurses do. So that adds to quality and safety, but what it also does is allow you to attract and retain highly qualified nurses. And boy, in a time of a shortage, is that important.
Yes. If you had an RN sitting with you right now, asking you the question whether they should go back to get a BSN, either FlexPath or a traditional model or not even Capella, right?
Yeah.
What questions should they be asking themselves? How should they be thinking about that question?
Well, they have, first of all, the most important question I think that you have to look at is, you know, do you have the, you know, first, a personal assessment, because no matter how flexible this is, nobody's saying that this doesn't take time and effort and money. So first is that personal assessment. Is this the right time for you, your family, and do you have the right resources, as, you know, and those are broadly defined to do it. Your answer, no matter what, your idea should be that this is going to be important to my career. So hopefully it'll be, if it's not now, then trying to figure out at what point in the future can you organize your life and your resources that you can do that. And then it's a matter of, you know, how can a program fit into how your personal set of circumstances and resources work. Yeah. One of the first things I always tell potential students to look for is to make sure that the program has programmatic accreditation. Look for that. So either, you know, for a bachelor's degree, the standard is the Collegiate Commission on Nursing Education programmatic certification accreditation. So that's really important to look at. And then truly what it is that I think I said that already. So it's, you know, can this work with your life?
What's the best advice you've gotten, either as a professional?
Oh, yeah. The best advice I got and the best advice I give, don't follow rules. I know that sounds strange. But nursing has struggled and been held back by traditional thinking. And, you know, we haven't taken our rightful place at the table in a lot of places. So, you know, breaking rules and going out and coloring outside the lines, I think nurses need a lot more of that. And a lot of that comes down to advocacy, you know, taking your place at the table, fighting for what is right for the patients. It's challenging for nurses because we tend to not have the structural power around us.
I was just going to say, I mean, there really are institutional structures built in such a way that I think it makes very difficult for nurses to do that.
It does, and one of the things that a magnet hospital must demonstrate directly and explicitly is a criteria called structural empowerment of nurses.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, and that's what it's about, because you are absolutely right. Hospital administrators and physicians, you know, we're a female-dominated profession, and hospital administration and medicine, although medicine has far greater strides in gender equality in its ranks, not in its leadership. So it's very – so, yes, the decks have been stacked against us. So it's very important that nurses are able to find their voice, their agency, and, you know, and choose places where they're allowed to do that. And that's what a magnet hospital does.
So you let's assume that there are learners in your school listening to this, and they are struggling with balancing a professional life and an academic life and then a personal life.
Absolutely.
What advice do you have for them in that balancing act? Mm-hmm. And B, what do you do for fun? What do you do to de-stress and what's fun for you?
Great. So a plate is only so big. Yep. and in the modern era and contemporary living, I don't know anyone who doesn't have a full plate. Yep. So thinking you're going to add school onto a full plate is probably not a strategy that is going to work.
Yep.
So that's part of that assessment. You got to look at that plate.
What do you
and
take off?
You got to take something off.
Yeah.
And that can be very, very complicated, and especially depending on what your support system is. And especially for, doctoral students and so forth, you know, there are certain parts of your personal life that there is no way that you're not going to have to shove that off the plate, and you have to make a lot of you have to apologize a lot to your spouses, partners, children, family members, and say, you know what, I will get to it, but it's not going to be till the weekend, or it's not going to be till Tuesday night, or it's not going to be till next year. So that's part of it. The other thing is, you know, there are things that you should not give up. There are things that you have to be. You cannot have all work and all school. That is very unhealthy. You can't let exercise and healthy eating and sleep fall off. Those are not healthy choices. So the more flexible the program, and I think Capella offers that flexibility. It's, you know, you don't get a prize the faster you do it. The goal is to get it done, and it's better to get it done. It's better to get it done eventually than get it done quicker if that's your only option.
I want to come back to what you do for fun, but has your research into, you said you don't do yoga or practice meditation. Has your research into exercise shaped kind of how you think about exercise?
Oh, absolutely.
How so?
Well, you know, I started exercising, and I try to do something every day of the week. And I started doing it because I wanted to look good. But what I've quickly realized that it is absolutely the number one contributor to my mental health, without question.
Yeah.
And that's not just psychological. That is a huge physiological basis for that. And it gives us the same way with healthy eating.
Yep.
It gives us the sense of control over our lives. You know, this is all, eating disorders are all wrapped into this. It's the one thing you can control, but you can control it all in a very healthy way also. So that feeling of control actually helps balance out a lot of things that you don't have control over. We all have bosses. We all have, you know, when you're a student, you have professors. We can't control that. We can't control other people's habits, but we can control whether we get on the treadmill.
Yep.
We can control whether we choose the apple or the donut. And that's very empowering to me. So I would definitely say that in times of stress, or if you're taking on school as an additional responsibility in your life, I hate to say it, but adding exercise and healthy eating on is actually a good thing.
I have just reached the point, we don't need to exchange ages, but I've just reached the point just in the last 2 years where if I, you talked about the physiological connection, if I don't exercise, I notice it.
And you get irritable probably.
Yeah, absolutely. It's huge.
And that's all physiological. That's not in your mind, by the
way. Yeah.
That is not.
What do you do for fun?
So I do exercise, and I do find that fun. I will run 10 miles at a time, and I find that incredibly relaxing. I have seen the world and will continue to see the world. I love traveling. The more exotic, the better. I love learning about other cultures. I love being immersed. And theater is my true passion. I live in Chicago. That's one of the reasons that I remain in Chicago. I see probably at least 3 plays a month, sometimes more than that. Last weekend I saw 3 just in the week, and I have 2 this Sunday. The fall season in Chicago is everyone's premiering everything, and I just love it.
What is the last show you saw that really wowed you?
Well, last weekend I saw 2 of my favorite musicals by smaller companies. One was called Next to Normal. Next to Normal is a wonderful musical about a woman dealing with bipolar disorder. And as a healthcare professional, it's just fascinating. It was a Pulitzer Prize winner. It's one of my absolute favorites. It's just the music is... I mean, this is about someone descending into just chaos and a suicide attempt and the emergence out of that. And I know it doesn't sound very happy, but it is such a moving piece of theater. And then last week there was I have a lot of cult favorites. There was a show that premiered in 1997 on Broadway called Sideshow. Got great critical acclaim and got a cult following back then. I was one of those individuals, but closed very quickly because it's the story of real conjoined twins. Daisy and Violet Hilton. Okay. And again, just the music soars. So a local production had done that. And then this weekend, I'm seeing one of my other favorite musicals, which is the stage version of American Idiot.
Yeah.
Which is Green Day. And it is the album.
Yeah.
But it's performance. So, yeah.
Right.
So that's the great thing about Chicago.
Great American city. But we're happy to have you in Minneapolis right
now. Thank you.
And we're thrilled you're a part of Capella. And it's been a great conversation. Let's do it again.
Absolutely.
Thank you.